Morning, everyone. Brad Spillane here, your host. For the Men's Mental Health Show, we've got a good show lined up today. Just a quick thanks to Dale Hunt from Mounties Group, also too to all manufacturing personnel, recruitment and labour hire in the manufacturing industry. Give us a call if you're looking for a job or if you're looking for some positions to be filled within your staff place. We've got all the staffing solutions on 0416 700 870. Big show lined up today. First show back after for one of our regulars. We had our first show back last week. It was actually quite a good show, and it was a terrific poem that you put together too, Boadster. But backing up after the RSV, or the big...
RSV. Respiratory syncytial virus, RSV.
One of the lesser known viruses. I don't think people are switched onto that being in the community at the moment.
Yeah, it's around, for sure. It kind of captured me and Annette big time, and still, you know, get a croaky voice occasionally and that sort of stuff. I'm 3 weeks on, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm no longer infectious, but it was a challenge to get through it. And I thought, I've got to actually do better at looking after myself. You know, I've got to think of myself as 73
years. I think you do pretty good. You eat well.
I do all that, but I go outside in shorts and no T-shirt or whatever, you know what I mean? I
think,
And that's how the virus will get you, straight up the shorts.
I'm going to burn all my shorts. Sorry.
It's like those leeches in the creek.
Did they pick it up on a COVID test? Did you go get a COVID test and they picked it up then?
Look, I did 3 tests, using those home testing kits.
Yeah.
And it was actually clean every time.
Yeah.
And I had another friend of mine who was on the same thing. She's a GP and, non-COVID, but had the RSV.
Yeah.
Did
you get a PCR test?
No.
Nasal swab? Because if you get a PCR at the hospital,
yes,
you get the nasal swab. They'll test for RSV at the same time.
At the same time.
And also the influenza A. So they'll pick up, they'll test those 3 things.
Well, next time I will do that.
Long pants from now on.
Yeah.
That's it. Thank you. I'm looking after my health, putting a jumper on, bit cool. Because I seem to be susceptible just to, the older I get to... those sorts of respiratory illnesses, colds, bronchial. I was a young kid, I was bronchial, so, you know. Mm.
I don't think it's actually got anything to do with the length of your pants. That was just me making fun.
But
it is probably something to do with immune senescence, which is what happens to the human body as we age. The immune system becomes less and less active.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's just one of the natural processes.
And we're talking about sleep, so it's part of me is going to sleep, my immune system.
Well, have you been getting enough sleep? Have you been getting enough sleep? Sleep deprived leading up to the...
I feel I sleep pretty well. I don't think I am sleep deprived. People say to me, and my wife says to me, you fall asleep very easily. You seem to sort of stay awake for most of the night. I maybe get up once or twice for a pee.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's only once. I fall pretty much straight to sleep. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, because I think the subject of today's show will be in part.
Yeah.
We'll be talking a bit about sleep.
Yes.
And we can talk about this a bit later. But in fact, it affects your immune system.
Okay.
If you're chronically sleep deprived, it actually at a cellular level.
Yes, impacts upon you.
It impacts your immune system and your ability to hunt down and destroy viruses and bacteria that are in the system.
Yeah.
So it's got implications. So hence why people who are sleep deprived are more prone to illness, picking up colds and things like that.
Yes.
That's one of the things that can happen.
Interesting word, though, the description, immune senescence. I'll have to think about that one. The other thing I've been recently reflecting on is the diaspora, where we come from, our cultural roots. There's a term called a diasporic identity. I think there's something really interesting in that, given our current voice debate.
Very much so.
I think all of us need to start to understand something of our cultural histories, from where we've come from, as a country as largely been driven by immigration, And also the you know, the cultural imperatives that come from Aboriginal occupation.
Sure.
This is their land, always was, always will be.
Sure.
So honouring that kind of the diaspora, the diaspora, the cultural heritage of the First Nation people is part of our obligation, as it is to honour where we come from. You know, what country we've come from, what cultural influences exist within us. That's a good conversation to have.
Mm. A sense of self is in firmly anchored in the ability to have a voice.
Absolutely.
Would you not say?
Like absolutely.
You know, your sense of self is being able to voice your concerns and your ideas and, you know, being valid, having a sense, well, being validated by people being able to listen, by being able to communicate as well. And,
well said. And learning listeners, You might think that having a voice, you know, is an obvious thing, but it actually not necessarily is an obvious thing. And I think we have to make these phenomena really clear and obvious. And if you have no voice, that is a form of disempowerment. And to have a voice is everything. I'm working with an elderly gentleman who's got Parkinson's, and he's just recently lost his wife very suddenly, and his voice is gone, and he's freaked out, you know, I mean, naturally, because all these losses that are happening for him, but it's including his voice. So to be heard is everything.
Mm. Same with stroke patients.
Yes.
Very frustrating.
Yes.
And very disabling. And it's one of the common symptoms of a stroke is to lose your capacity for speech. Either no speech at all, aphasia, or difficult speech. Sometimes expressive aphasia, which is where they have the speech is disabled in a way where words are jumbled and don't make sense. And it's one of the things that we assess when we do our stroke assessment, their capacity for forming not only the letters but being able to construct a sentence and things like that.
Yeah.
So,
I had a good friend of mine recently, Phil Franks. He was a colourful character as a young lad. He played rugby league for many clubs: Penrith, North West, Manly. And he was originally a client of mine. I sold a lot of properties for up on North Kilkill, called the Windy Drop Down Estate, probably the most prestigious estate in the Northern Beaches. And he was a genius, not very well educated, grew up in boys' homes, but to come from where he was to where he is was devastating. And he had a stroke, and he was down at Mona Vale. He's very lucky. And they couldn't believe, Paula, his partner, said she just couldn't believe how quickly the ambulance got there.
Okay.
And if it was, they reckon if it was 4 or 5 minutes later, then it just sort of goes in stages. You lose your speech, you lose your, and it, you know. And he's lost some movement down the left side, but he's lucky he's got his speech. You know?
Wow!
But that was 5.5 minutes it took.
Oh, wow!
It was just phenomenal. Yeah.
That is a good response time. And in fact, that was one of the effects that we saw through COVID.
Yeah,
was that the workload in certainly across Australia, but certainly I know in New South Wales, had increased exponentially to a point where we were struggling to maintain effective response times. The workload was that high, we couldn't put enough bums on seats in ambulances to be able to respond to people in a very timely fashion. Thankfully, that's tapered away, and we're back to where we were pre-COVID, I think, at the moment, and response times are excellent. So
That's terrific. I had to step out a moment ago, and I know you were starting to talk about sleep. It's a topic that's very close to my heart and very, very far away or foreign to my mind, because, as you know, I struggle with sleep at times. So I had a tooth removed, another molar, yesterday, and I would be lucky to get an hour and a half bit here and there. And it's like, I guess, you know, when I have pain, it's the lack of sleep really wears you down. And I've said this a number of times, like yourself, being a first responder, being a psychotherapist. Anyone and everyone I know in the medical field has always said the same thing. We can't treat you until you sleep first. And it's the most important thing, isn't it? I mean, people that have lack of sleep, we know it causes early onset death, amongst other things. So why?
So do that. Can I just ask? So so when you when you've received assistance in the past, so that is something that's part of their clinical assessment, assessing your sleep state
straight away. So if I've gone into a rehab, the first thing they want to do is get me to sleep. Now they may give me something to help me sleep. But that gets taken away after a couple of days because ideally you don't want to be dependent on something that makes you sleep like an antipsychotic or a Valium.
And it's not quality sleep either.
No, it isn't. No, it's not. Well, you're not, you know, sleeping clearly, you dream or, you know, you have those thoughts. Well, but having, you know, sleep with, you know, sleeping tablets or whatever, you wake up feeling like you've been hit by a bus.
Yes.
So it's, you're no good the next day or certainly not for the first 6 or 7 hours anyway. So, but I think, you know, for me, because I have a lot of mania and I think about a lot of things all the time. I've got 100 things going. Just looking at you two blokes now, I'm thinking of 3 or 4 different things, you know.
Yeah.
So it's, I found, which when I'm able to, is to bring things back to the breath, to slow things right down, to try and clear what those thoughts are. And then that can make life a little bit slower for me. Mm. And once things slow down, then I'm able to have a good sleep.
Okay.
But the funny thing is, with my situation, the more I'm awake, the faster I think.
Yeah.
Isn't that strange? You know, if anyone was awake for 2 or 3 days, they'd be like, God, I can't wait to get to sleep.
Yeah.
I just go faster and faster. I talk faster. I think faster.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not good.
Yeah, okay. Is that somewhat addictive in a way? Like, is that sort of, is there a sense of satisfaction associated with that?
Yeah, I guess it can be. I guess it can be in a sense, you know, but it's not until those that are closest to me, and my father particularly, will say, mate, slow down. Mm. And then I go back and self-assess and go, all right, well, because I think I'm fine. I think I'm real fine. I mean, I'm coming up with the jokes, quick-witted, and I'm, you know, I'm almost thinking exactly what you're thinking ahead of before you say it.
Yes.
And I've been known to sort of do that, you know.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, because what happens after that, it's like anything. If that's going up, it's just the rule of gravity, isn't it?
Yeah.
What goes up and then I crash, I'll come down. And then I'll have 2 days of real heavy depression or down or, you know, self non-existence of, you know, or self-sabotage. I'll spend money or do things. So it's such an important thing to get sleep. And it was the year before where it was just out of control. I had to go in a couple of times to get my sleep done right. And I'm lucky I've got a psychiatrist who's more towards me learning the skills of how to manage my sleep as opposed to him writing a prescription. So, which I'm sure he'll do if I ask, but he knows that ideally that's not what I'm after. I'm after, you know, I need to get out of the environment where I am. I'm here to get, just think about myself, not think about other things that are going on, my kids, you know, my mum or my dad, and then, you know, everything else outside of
that. Set up a proper framework for it.
Yeah. Okay. So it's about putting those skills or those priorities in place. And when we go in there, we try not to think about those things. And the funny thing is, after 3 or 4 days, when you start to sleep, then you're able to bring those things back into your life.
Yeah, okay.
And then you're able to make those phone calls that you otherwise didn't want to make or were afraid of what you were going to say.
Sleep's one of those funny states. I mean, we spend a third of our lives doing it, ideally.
Wow. Yeah.
And I think it's one of those states where if you're getting good sleep, you're almost, you can almost take it for granted.
Yeah.
You know? Because everything should be working optimally, in a sense.
Well, you almost don't want to tell anyone.
You know, and it's not really until you're deprived of sleep. Even just a single night's sleep, a single night of shortened sleep can have quite a detrimental effect on your life, on your following days. But to have chronic loss of sleep is almost a type of hell on earth, really, in a sense, because it everything then becomes suboptimal after that.
Yeah.
It's very hard to achieve excellence if you're sleep deprived. And I think any new parent with a crying baby would attest to that.
Yeah.
In fact, I think anyone who is about to have a child come into their lives would probably be somewhat nervous about the lack of sleep.
That's a nice word.
about to enter their lives. But also, you know, for example, I think modernity gets in the way of good sleep in terms of things like shift work, Sure. And distractions and telecommunications and our connectedness to the world, when in fact we just need to disconnect in order to reconnect with ourselves.
Yes. Some adolescent boys sort of create in their bedroom of what is effectively an electronic fort, and they're saturated right throughout the night, by their various modalities that they've got.
Yeah.
So it's either gaming sort of running in the background, or some mate ring, 2 o'clock, can't sleep, rings up and the phone's on 24/7, so you engage in the conversation.
Yeah.
And sleep actually is almost a non-existent phenomenon.
Mm.
And then they wonder why they're not doing that well at school, and they're drowsy and they're falling asleep.
Well, I've got that issue with my son at the moment, you know.
Okay.
He's away from where his mum is, so he's in a separate part of the house, which if she wants to go and check on him, she has to walk outside and down to the backyard where he is.
Okay.
So he's gaming all the time. He's not sleeping a lot, and you can tell.
Yeah.
And even when he came and stayed with us over Christmas, it was,
And somewhat dangerous too for,
I was going to say,
a teenager where the brain is still in development.
Yeah.
So why is that?
Why is it dangerous?
Yeah.
I think, we don't have our full adult brains until we're about 25 for a start.
Right.
So I think anything that we do up until that point is we're forming the neuronal connections. We're wiring ourselves for habits. We're wiring ourselves to different parts of the brain. We're learning new skills.
Mm.
And it's in that neuroplasticity stage. I mean, we have neuroplasticity throughout our entire lives. That essentially means that we can reform our brains and reform the neural connections right from, from when we're born through to when we die. We can learn new skills. We can form new emotions. Yep. We can form new habits. We can do that sort of thing right up and through to very old age.
Mm.
But I think at that stage, I mean, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I would suggest that we're highly susceptible up until about age 25 in terms of the habits that we establish and so on and so forth. And
A good book on that. I mentioned it a couple of years ago, a book called Buddha's Brain. It's written by neuroscientists, and it just, everything that you said is pretty much what the book is about, rewiring, retraining, understanding. Because your brain is automatically programmed to remember negative thoughts 80% of the time. Very rarely will it hold or restore positive thoughts. So you have to continually train your brain to understand this thing, and that goes for sleep and a lot of other things. What about as a psychotherapist, when you have somebody come in and they tell you their sleep's interrupted or that they're not sleeping too well, why is it as a physician to have good sleep from your perspective?
Well, I think sleep is a very protective aspect of our functioning. The restorative stuff that goes on during sleep is well documented. So there's regenerative activity going on around cellular repair, that sort of stuff. There's memory consolidation. The function of dreams is one way in which the brain is making interesting associations and patterning, and the people that show up in our dreams are aspects of our own sort of self, and it's all very helpful for material that's going on while we sleep. So the reality of sleep, rather than it's lost time, it has a real function in terms of actually our ability to function fully in our wake time. So there's a lot going on in sleep, and when you're sleep deprived, there is a starvation of cognitive function as a result of sleep deprivation. And that's not fully appreciated, particularly when we're excited by something and sleep's in the way of stuff, so we sort of forego sleep. But in terms of the modernity also, the increasing complexity of our reality, because we're saturated with much more information than we've ever had to actually process, that too puts a cognitive load on our functioning. And if you're sleep deprived, you're further compromised. The other thing, the reality of existence is that it's context laden. So what does that mean? It means that whatever experiencing we're having, that's our context, and our brains have been shaped by the context that we are having. And if we have insufficient time or opportunity for integration of experience, that too then can become a complication in terms of making use of experience, of understanding that the experience that I'm having is shaping me, and I have some choices as to how to understand what's going on for me. And the more that we can understand our experience and our context, the more that we can make informed choices. And informed choices is the basis for living well. If we and a lack of sleep compromises the ability to make informed choices.
It affects our attention.
Absolutely.
And from what I understand from the research that I've been looking at is that, first of all, sleep deprivation is cumulative, as in it you acquire sleep deprivation over time. So what they've done is they've done studies where they've looked at, for example, they compared a group of people who had no sleep for 3 days, a group of people who had sleep for 6 hours a night, another group at 4 hours a night, and another group who had 8 hours of sleep a night. And they monitored them for 2 weeks.
Wow, interesting. Yeah.
And what they did was they then had performance tasks, attention tasks that they had to attend to during that time. And what they found was that obviously the people who had no sleep after one night, there was a marked effect on their ability to attention. Two nights, even more so. Three nights, disastrous.
They actually compared it, I beg your pardon to interrupt, they actually compared it too, to people that were two and three times over the limit with alcohol.
Yes, yes.
Yep. And they put the same similarities with those that had lack of sleep. I saw this. Yeah.
Very, very similar. Yeah. So what they found was that people who had 6 hours of sleep per night, then after only just a few days, or actually by, it was actually, no, it was longer. It was by the end of the 2 weeks, if you only had 6 hours sleep a night, your level of attention was very similar to if you'd missed an entire night's sleep. Wow. So in terms of the level of attention. Wow. And what they found then also was that if you only had 4 hours of sleep per night, at the end of the 2 weeks, that was very similar to someone who had not slept for two nights.
Wow.
So it's over time, even though you're still getting some sleep, if you're not getting the full recommended, I think they say somewhere it's between seven to eight, 9 hours per night, depending on your age, obviously. And one of the things they found too is that obviously as you're younger, you sleep more, and as you age, you sleep less, which can be one of the frustrations for people who are older, is that I just can't get to sleep, and they end up often on sleeping tablets, which is another problem which then they can have effects with. Yeah, so it's cumulative. So it's not just, you know, a couple, even just after, in a short term, if you lose a night's sleep, you lack of attention, you end up with a lack of attention.
Yep, yeah.
And lack of attention means then in terms of your ability to make executive decisions.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Something else that's interesting that they looked at too was that if you deprive a person of sleep and then you put them in an MRI scanner and you get them to perform and respond to different emotional tasks, is that at a very fundamental, at the base of the brain is a structure called the amygdala.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the amygdala regulates intense emotion. So it regulates fear, panic, and things like anger. And it's very much part of the sympathetic nervous system. It's part of your flight and fight response.
Yeah.
So that if you're startled or if you suddenly have to fight for your life, the amygdala fires up and you become a hellcat, which is all very good and well if you have to fight for your life. But in the modern world, we rarely have to use the amygdala in terms of, it's not called upon in terms of our day-to-day life. And instead, the human brain has evolved to develop the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain that's at the front of the head, sort of in above the eyes, and it makes us unique as Homo sapiens. And the prefrontal cortex is the executive decision-making area of the brain. And it is the regulator of intense emotion. So what happens is if the amygdala fires off, the prefrontal cortex suppresses that. And there's afferent and efferent connections backwards and forwards between the two of them.
Yep.
And the prefrontal cortex, the executive part of the brain, says, no, we're not required. I'm in charge. You need to regulate that emotion, calm down, and then it exerts a parasympathetic effect, which is about the calming component.
Right.
And it allows us to make decisions, to plan our lives, to set ourselves up for success and so on. And what lack of sleep does is it directly affects the ability of the prefrontal cortex to regulate the amygdala.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, lack of sleep, what they were saying is it affects you about, it increases its activity by about 60%.
Mm.
So we are more prone to intense emotions with lack of sleep. And that would mean also poor decision making at times.
Absolutely.
Lack of attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
And inability to form long-term memories.
Yes.
And to essentially be in a calmed state.
Yes. And I think there's also a loss of hope. Hope, which is another component of executive decision making, that if you're deprived of sleep and hope is no longer accessible to you, it feeds that arousal system in the amygdala in terms of fight, flight, or fragmenting or freezing. This is a very interesting discussion, and at some level we also talk about it as mastery. How does one develop some mastery over the executive function, which is able to actually look at what's going on around you in a way that doesn't immediately lead to fight or flight, which is the amygdala response. And that sort of mastery of those aspects of self can make a huge difference in the sort of life that you end up living. So this mastery journey is really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And all of us are called to actually step into obtaining some mastery over our own functioning. That's the requirement. Mm. Sentience requires that of us. Yeah. There's no negotiation on this. Mm. Yeah.
And a bit of common sense dictates, as commonly spoken, that if you have something difficult to say, if you're feeling angry towards someone, don't just fire off a text or a phone call or fly off the handle. You should sleep on it.
Yes.
Now, why do we say that? You should sleep on it. Yeah. Because, of course, after a night's sleep, you're calmer.
You're able to think clearer, make those decisions about,
put together something that's perhaps a little more tempered and we've got some more control over, as opposed to just flying off the handle and saying something you shouldn't.
So I think it's fair to say that if we're not getting our sleep, it's potentially a dangerous thing.
It is a dangerous thing. And you know what's really interesting is that the cancel culture that exists in our society is because we actually are all sleep deprived.
Mm, good point.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah,
increasingly, insufficient sleep is leading us to act preemptively to say, I hate that person, I'm going to cancel them.
Yeah.
Not to sleep on it and to return to an equilibrium, but to actually act impulsively. Mm. So these are some of the things that we're offering warnings to say, we're heading for complications that we can pull back from and actually come back to a place of stillness as an act of mastery.
Mm. Mm.
I agree. This is great, boys. I tell you what, let's just hold that. We'll go to a quick announcement from some sponsors. It's a Men's Mental Health Show. I just want to say thanks to Christian Mortensen and, of course, co-host, good mate, Bodie Marsden here, psychotherapist. Of course, you can get Bodie on 0424 416 969. 0424 416 969. Let's just see if one of these work. Let's see how this goes. All right. No, it's not working today. All right, let's kick on.
We've got more to say anyway.
We can come back to that at any time anyway.
One of the winning jokes of the Edinburgh Festival some years ago. It's not my joke. But do you know how Captain Snooze rose to the lofty heights of being captain?
No.
Well, he slept his way there.
Oh, good on you, Dad.
Not my gag, but it was a winner.
He slept his way there. That's great. It's wonderful.
I bet he drove a triple Z. So I've got to keep running the puns.
One of the standard jokes in our family is my sister was in Namiya with my dad and a brother, and they were in a tent.
Oh, yeah.
And a young man took an interest in my sister and sort of was trying to entice her to come out. And she said, you better not talk, and you better, you know, go away, because my father is a very light sleeper. In the meantime, he's in the next tent snoring.
And he can hear him going away.
Totally demolished her.
He was one step ahead.
Oh, one step ahead. Mm. I know that, yeah, I remember one morning, I mean, I'm a shift worker, so I've been doing night shifts for close on 25 years now. And I am a little concerned that what the effect of that will be on,
sure,
on my health and well-being. One, you know, does it make me less resilient to the things that I have to deal with? And it most certainly does. I know that one of the worst possible and the most awful jobs that we have to go to are the jobs on night shift when I'm sleep deprived.
Mm.
And often those jobs are early morning jobs when somebody wakes up to find somebody in cardiac arrest or deceased in their house,
yeah,
which can happen overnight. And then we're suddenly having to fire off into full action, all guns sort of going clinically, and sort of attempt a resuscitation, and then trying to think straight in amongst all of that. And when I started in my career, we were doing 14-hour night shifts,
wow,
which went from 6 in the evening through to 8 in the morning. And often extensions of shift beyond that.
Well, if you're dropping someone at hospital too, you can be there for another 2 hours.
You end up with another 2 hours.
Yeah.
And they were the worst. They mm-hmm. were really, really awful. And you would be absolutely wiped out. And I'd be driving home, you know, trying to combat fatigue,
mm-hmm,
and keeping my eyes awake, and eventually, you know, I feel it, I just pull over and on the side of the road and sleep. Mm. But very detrimental. But it also affects things like lack of sleep affects things like insulin resistance. So it makes you more prone to diabetes.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And weight gain.
Yeah.
So it's not just about your cognitive state. It's about your ability to regulate your metabolism at a very fundamental level, in terms of resistant to insulin. If you're insulin resistant, it basically means you're pre-diabetic.
All right.
And you're sort of like a type 2 diabetes. You might end up on medication tablets for that sort of stuff. And then there's in relation to immune function as well. If you're sleep deprived, as we mentioned earlier in the show, that it affects your ability to fight viruses and bacteria and lymphatic flow and things like that. So affect your ability to battle disease.
Christian, are you one of those people that, like, let's just say you've come off a shift now, right? Are you able to just sort of go home and go, right, I'll sleep for the next 4 hours? Can you switch off like that? Can you do that?
I'm so lucky. I can sleep at the drop of a hat.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? I mean, do you think it's something in your genes? Do you think it's something that you've trained yourself to do? Or?
Yeah, look, in part, yes, something that I've trained myself to do.
Right.
I've reserved the bedroom purely for sleeping.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So when I go into the bedroom and lie down, I know that's what it's for.
That's a very good...
So I'm not in there to work or sometimes, obviously, I'll read. I do a lot of reading. And that helps me sort of calm and relax and that sort of thing before I go to sleep. And look, I still sort of wake up some nights and wake up. Usually I wake up at 2 in the morning if I'm sleeping over a night. And,
right.
And then sort of, but then if I just read for a little while, then I'll sort of fall back asleep very quickly.
Right.
But I'm very fortunate. And it's in some sense, my wife, April, she gets a bit frustrated by that, is that, like, for example, I can, in the car, if I am driving and I'm feeling drowsy, I know immediately I'll have to stop driving.
Right.
So she'll take over driving, and then I'll get into the passenger seat. I'll put my seat back, and then I'll be asleep in 30 seconds.
Wow.
And I can sleep. I can plan my sleep. I know that I can sleep for 10 minutes, or I can sleep for 20, and I can set that limit in my mind. And at 10 minutes or 20, 30 minutes, whatever I've set up in my mind, I'll wake up. And I'll feel completely refreshed.
He's a sleep god.
Absolutely, sleep god.
And that's, I don't know how I just do that. I go, I think a 10-minute nap would be good. And then at the end of 10 minutes, bang, I'm awake. And feeling
And
very,
those little
very
power
refreshed.
Naps can do wonders, can't they? You know,
very much.
I mean, I'm able to do that occasionally, which is great. You know, you get those, you feel like you... just recharge for 4 hours.
Oh, definitely, you know? Definitely. I'll endeavour, if I've got some downtime on shift, most afternoons I'll try and get a power nap in, even just like a 10-minute power nap. And just it sets you up for success. You just feel so much energy my attention is sharper, especially in relation to things like driving or a task where you're just sort of sitting or reading or something like that where your attention can wander. So I highly recommend power naps. I think the Mediterranean cultures have got it there on us. They set themselves up with power naps.
The old siestas.
The old siesta. There's a lot to be said for that. And that, maybe that's got a lot to do with their longevity as well.
It's amazing. Sure. Didn't we talk last time about the Japanese? There's a village,
in Okinawa?
Okinawa, that's it, yeah, where their average lifespan is in the 90s or something.
Yeah, they're all centenarians.
So, we're second. There's a place here as well in Australia, north, I think it's like...
Is it a retirement village?
If the whole town is, maybe that's how they get the meme from that. Oh dear, very, very good.
It could
very
be somewhere
good.
In the mid mountains.
This is absolutely is the place to be, isn't it?
It is. Clean air.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is another thing. I remember one morning, one of the first things we do is we're coming in for day shift. I arrive and we inevitably ask night shift. How was the night shift? Did you get some sleep? Did you get some downtime? And, you know, people will then give a report on how the night was and so on. And I remember one night I had some sleep that night and day shift came in and one of our paramedics, Andrew, said to me, "Christian, look at your hair."
You had the bedhead.
Right, I had my hair was all askew. And I said, "Andrew, I've got two important points to raise about this. One, I've got bed hair, which means I put my head on the pillow for a substantial amount of time. And secondly, I've got hair." So take that.
Yeah.
He said, "Good point, Christian."
I bet you he never brought that up again.
No, he didn't.
But, you know, we're sort of laughing about stuff, and it's good to have humour while we're talking about this, but... For those people who are sleep sufferers, this can be an agony. And I've heard many people say, they're tearing their hair out because of lack of sleep, not being able to fall asleep and all that sort of stuff. So I think this is a phenomenon that's happening more and more and more. And I think modernity is part of the challenges increasingly where sleep is poorly understood and is constantly sacrificed. So I think we have to come to a more simpler way of existing. And otherwise, we're at risk of becoming unable to function and become sort of kind of loose cannons within our own selves and in our relationships. And I think this is a really serious issue. Mm. It's bigger than the economy. It's a really serious issue. Mm. The compromises we make around sleep and the power of sleep as a restorative. For well-being, mental health, and having a cultural life, having a community life. Mm. These things are all factors. Mm. And, this is... I know in a few years' time, suddenly there'll be a huge inquiry as to the lack of sleep that's going on in the community. Mm. We'll have a royal commission. Mm. At the moment, we treat it as a peripheral issue, but it actually is it's a biggie.
And we've unfortunately, some people equate a good night's sleep with a sense of laziness.
Yes,
you're a lazy person if you know you've got time to sleep. When quite the opposite. In fact, we're more productive with sleep under our belts, and it's a fundamental component of well-being.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the causes for lack of sleep of insomnia. There's many causes apart from things like if you're unfortunately like me having to work shift work, but having the sort of the busy mind that prevents people from getting to sleep. There's some age related stuff that goes on as well. I think typically speaking that it's an issue that is exacerbated with age. That as we age, some people, not all people, but I see it commonly in the community, where people end up taking sleeping tablets as they age. The problem with that is that the tablets that are commonly prescribed for sleep are temazepam.
Yeah, which is benzodiazepine. Yeah. But temazepam does absolutely nothing for me.
That's
nothing
right.
I mean, and I had to take four at once.
And they have done studies on temazepam, and it literally will improve your sleep for a couple of nights, and then after that it won't work. And people are on this medication chronically. They spend years on temazepam.
Wow.
What they also know is that temazepam is a centrally acting drug, which it's not a psychotropic, but it what it does do is blunts your reflexes.
It's a benzoid.
Yeah, it's a benzo.
Yeah.
So it slows down the brain function.
Yeah.
And it is definitively linked to your increased falls risk. Wow. So falls in the community amongst aged people is very, very common. It's one of our most common jobs that we'll go to in aged people falling over. Mm. And if they're lucky, they'll get away with being uninjured. If they're unlucky, a broken hip, broken limbs, head injuries, that sort of thing. And sometimes we'll find people who've fallen and have been on the floor for hours, if not days.
Wow.
Which is an absolute medical disaster for
me. Yeah.
But it is linked to, amongst other things, to temazepam use. So people, you're at risk for 48 hours after one temazepam tablet.
So they're going from, a common pattern is you can go from temazepam into diazepam or Valium. But what happened, I think, about 10 to 15 years ago, correct me if I'm wrong here, is that I certainly noticed that they started taking people away from benzos and started including things like quetiapine or Seroquel.
Yep.
Now, and they did that because it's extremely unlikely to overdose.
Yes.
From quetiapine.
And that's right.
It falls under the category of an antipsychotic. It's an antipsychotic. But so they knew it started to become a safer drug, but then became issues, kidneys or something?
I'm not sure what the side effects of... We see a lot of quetiapine use in the community.
Right.
And it's used for behavioural stuff, for things like borderline personality disorders and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's got a fairly safe profile by comparison to
some of the other benzoids like or something.
Tricyclic antidepressants. They're the worst, right? They can be fatal if you overdose on those.
Yeah.
And benzos can also be fatal, especially if used in combination with opiates.
Mm.
So, and alcohol. Mm. All the classic downers.
Yeah. You get just suppresses
the triple
breathing.
Whammy of benzos, alcohol, and opiates.
And then
you're gone.
Yeah, stop your breathing. Your breathing slows right down and stops.
You drift off.
You might as well have taken a massive heroin overdose.
Yeah.
So it's, so very, very dangerous. And over time, very ineffective as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be regulated very, very, very carefully. In terms of use, but in terms of
it's very interesting, boys. It's a good conversation. This I'm really
Look, I think in terms of for people, it could be utilised in the short term, like we're talking about. You need an extra night's sleep, that sort of thing. But if you're chronically sleep deprived, then I think you need to fundamentally look at how you're set up in your life.
So that brings me back to where we were initially said, right? These things that we use to aid us to sleep, and in actual fact, and this is even from my own experience that I can say, that yes, the temazepam will work for a night or two. It doesn't work. It doesn't matter what the sleep aid is. After time of using that, you will need more.
Yeah, that's right.
And the reason why a lot of us go down that track is because we are lazy.
Mm.
We are not prepared to put in the work. We are not prepared to practice our breathing. We're not prepared to put things aside. We're not prepared to make commitments of the bedroom being for sleep.
Yeah.
Not for watching the phone or the iPad.
Yeah.
Having a TV in your bedroom. All of these things are terrific things to have, and such as what Bodhi's saying, for the cancel culture, for the fact that we have come so close to judge, we don't have the patience anymore. The amygdala is fighting with the
prefrontal cortex.
Prefrontal cortex. And ultimately, there's only going to be one winner in that, when really they should be working together with a lot of things.
Yeah.
And this is something that you should be working together with either your partner, or if you're at home, you're a young boy like my son, setting up things with your mum, just say, these are the boundaries. We must turn off gaming by 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Because in the long run, the impacts that it's going to have, particularly on the younger people, is...
Mm.
It's quite scary.
It's one of those things we just have to optimize. And I think that's probably best to have a multimodal approach to it. So that involves things like maintaining good sleep hygiene, which is about setting up your bedroom for sleeping, as opposed to gaming or you know, partying or doing, I mean, obviously bedrooms are used for other things as well.
You've got to have the workbench.
You've got to have the workbench. And after a good workout, you probably, you'll probably have a better night's sleep.
Straight to sleep.
You'll have a better night's sleep.
You don't need a cigarette.
So it's always good to have a good workout before bedtime. I'm not saying don't do that. But, sort of, I guess, looking at things like making sure you're getting good exercise, making sure you're avoiding stimulants like coffee, alcohol as well. Having alcohol in the evening isn't necessarily conducive to a good night's sleep, like a quality sleep where you're going through, you know, good deep sleep, REM sleep, where you're dreaming.
See, I'll often have a couple of beers. This is, I'm not a big drinker, but I might have a couple of beers at the end of work and I just want to go to sleep. You know? I know that if I have one or two more, it'll be the opposite. I'll be up all night.
So, look, everything in moderation, though, isn't it?
Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? So there's that. Having your bedroom set at the right temperature, too. It's better to have a colder bedroom than a warmer bedroom in terms of quality of sleep. Otherwise, you toss and turn and you sweat and you're feeling uncomfortable and that sort of thing. So getting your bedroom set up for about 18 degrees Celsius is probably about an optimal temperature. I know I have a better night's sleep if it's cooler.
It's
slightly
cooler.
That's something I didn't know as well. I think
And then addressing things like sleep apnea. That'll be a big problem for some people too, males and females, and not necessarily people that are carrying a lot of weight. You can have sleep apnea, which is obstructive sleep apnea, where your airway closes in the middle of sleep, and this is where you're snoring loudly, and your snoring is essentially vibrations in your upper airway at the back of the tongue. And the in the nasopharynx and the oropharynx, which is at the back of the
tongue meets the back of the throat,
which is where in sleep the tongue falls back, and as your inhalation exhalation, that area obstructs and vibrates, and can actually obstruct your breathing to the point where you become apneic, which is not breathing for a prolonged period of time. Now that is very dangerous.
Yes.
Dangerous chronically over long periods of time, and also dangerous acutely in that it can actually, and I think there's probably some evidence to suggest that it can be linked to premature death, in people who have it very severely. And this is why people who have been diagnosed with it, A1, weight loss can be very useful in terms of freeing up the structures around the neck. In terms of you've got less weight the airway.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors in play here, and there is a lot of things that your physician can tell you to do. There's actually a device that you can put on top of your nose or something inside your teeth. There's several different things besides medication.
Besides medication. So there's physical aids that you can utilise, sleep aids, which either open up the nose itself so that you've got less resistance through the nose itself. You've got various like biting devices that will hold the jaw slightly forward, which basically pulls the tongue away from the back of the airway. And then you've got CPAP devices, which are your positive pressure airway assist devices, which you can be assessed for. You can pick up at the pharmacy. It's a little machine that runs by the bed. It's a mask that sits over your mouth or mouth and nose, depending on which device that you've got, which exerts a positive pressure in your airway, keeps the airway open. And as a consequence, you don't have these apneic, non-breathing episodes as you're sleeping. And I think that can be substantially improved people's sleep. I've not had to use one, but from what I understand, people who do use them, they're essential, for a good night's sleep.
And there are treatments where you can get a diagnosis where you go to a sleep clinic and they'll set you up.
They're turning up all over the place too.
And they can determine from your sleep pattern whether or not you have an apnea issue going on. And of course, one of the problems about apnea is that you have to wake up because you're suddenly starved of oxygen. And so your sleep is compromised because you might be waking up 60 times in the hour, even more for people who have a severe apnea condition. So to treat that is crucial to a restoration of a good night's sleep.
And not only for the sufferer of the apnea, but also their partner. Let's not underestimate the effects of snoring and sleep apnea on your bed partner. And I think it pays to be a little bit flexible around these things and having a dual bedroom setup. Whereby if you needed a good night's sleep that you had an alternative you know, to being able to, if your partner's a heavy snorer and you just can't get to sleep,
you get kicked out,
or going to another room and then being able to get
some of us
night's
just
sleep.
Call that the doghouse, mate.
Well, it doesn't have to be a punishment.
No, but
it could be, you know, something. I guess, you know, it depends how much importance
it's not really to. Coming from a place of love.
No, but it's hard to come from a place of love if you're sleep deprived.
Isn't that true? It's so true. You know, you look at it and you think, you know, when but people see it with me all the time. You know, I'll go to work and Craig might say to me, "Hey, man, are you all right today?" And it's because I bring it back down. It's probably a lot to do with the fact it comes down to sleep. If I might say, "Oh, look, you know, I'm not talking to Jeremy at the moment," or something else is coming, you might think that's the reason, but there's a reason why that's not happening. And if you bring it back, it quite often can be sleep.
Yeah, you know.
So think about that.
There's a variety of different conditions. I suffer from restless leg syndrome, which is very common, a very common neurological disorder. Which is, I think it's 1 in 10 people have it, somewhere around those statistics. And it's basically, I've got to move my legs. Yeah. When I lie down, I can be sitting, that's fine. But as soon as I lie down, I've got to wriggle my legs and move them. And if I don't wriggle my legs, it's this intense sensation that builds up sort of inside my body and then it makes me want to just sort of jump up.
Like Shrek. I can't feel my legs!
Something like that. So, but I'm lucky in that my wife... when I do the leg foot sort of wriggling thing at nighttime, it's actually, she finds it quite soothing. Like the bed is sort of being rocked from side to side.
You're not
side
trying
gently.
To get a leg up on her. She doesn't that think it's happen. A sign.
Hey, honey, this is restless leg syndrome. I'm just going to get a leg over.
All of these things are, they're
so that can happen
stuff,
too. And what it actually, funnily enough, one of the treatments for that is restless leg syndrome is opiates, is endone. And I noticed this some years ago. I fractured my shoulder really badly, and I ended up on endone to help manage the pain. Which in part suppressed the restless legs. But when I had to taper my endone use back to zero, the most frustrating thing about that was not that there was pain in my shoulder. It was the intense resurgence of restless leg syndrome to the point of absolute insanity. It was like a rebound reaction.
And
that was the toughest, for me, that was the toughest part of coming off the
end
on, was the intense restless legs. It was, it just drove me crazy. And eventually, after a couple of days of persisting with it, it sort of tapered away. But I've spoken to other users of who've got chronic pain, who are prescribed endone, and I asked them about that. And if they suffer from restless legs, if they then run out of their endone prescription, their restless leg symptoms go from 0 to 10 out of 10, and it's a great source of frustration for them and loss of sleep.
I'll
tell you what, it worked for me last night. I was listening to Schubert's number 9 quintet. His last piece of work that he wrote before he died. So he died a month after. And the manuscript was given to a friend and it was lost for 50 years and it was suddenly discovered in a drawer that was going to be thrown out. And, you know, it's one of the most beautiful pieces of work. For two cellos and three violins, and it's the most exquisite Schubert's number 9 quintet, and it's the most exquisite piece of music. And he was at the peak of his powers, but he was also coming to the end of his life, and it is just a magnificent emotional piece of work, and. I put the headphones.
I was going to play some of it, but it's 47 bloody
minutes. Yes.
Listeners can listen in.
But
I've got my leg over Vachi here.
Good piece of classical music for sleep is great.
Absolutely. I just slept like a log after that. Had the earphones on, feeding it through the computer, through YouTube. What an exquisite piece of music. So,
we've got a 3-minute version, which I might stick on.
The other thing is, we talk about sleep hygiene now, like we talk about dental hygiene, brush your teeth, that sort of stuff. And sleep hygiene is kind of saying that the act of sleep is important for me, so I have to do some prep for it. So I don't treat it as an automatic response. I just lay down. I've got to do some things to prepare for sleep. And one of them is to not consume things that rev you up, like coffee, like stimulants or coffee. Yeah. So you might have a 4-hour period before you are going to sleep.
Yeah.
To prepare for that you're not in front of your computer working feverishly to produce an assignment. Yeah. All of that's hostile to sleep. So because they're all arousal things. But good sleep hygiene is preparing yourself for sleep, and bringing yourself down into a place of stillness and getting quality sleep. If you need to do an assignment, do it in the morning. Get 7 or 8 hours under your belt. And you're refreshed, and the brain's fully alive to it. And you know what happens at night time is during the night, the brain's working as well. It's the most active piece of our, in terms of our function, bodily function, and it's processing and integrating. And you will actually write a better essay after a good night's sleep.
No, it's a great point.
And the dreaming. That's about the sort of the processing of the events of the day, isn't it? Of putting that into focus,
formation
of long term memories, and the regulation of stress that you might have felt through the day.
Yep.
By dreaming about it, we take the sharp edges off those experiences.
Absolutely.
We dull them and we can process them and sort of fit them into a framework where we can understand them.
And people who dream, who have developed a capacity to dream and remember their dreams, will inevitably get dreams that are hugely inspirational, are hugely referential, deep in their understanding of who they are. So the dreaming function, when you pay attention to it, will deliver a dreaming content that will blow your socks off.
Definitely. I know I've had troubles I remember this one time I had trouble with a physical puzzle, like one of those things you pick up in a puzzle shop.
Yes.
Where you've got to fit pieces together and try and work out how they work. And I couldn't work out how this thing went together. And I dreamt the solution to it. And when I woke up, it fitted together perfectly, just like I dreamt it. Capable of remarkable stuff.
It is
remarkable, isn't
and
it?
You think about one of the most popular movements in modern art. Surrealism, which is based sort of roughly around the dreaming state and how we connect to that, and how connecting to the subconscious and its effect. And
We come back to dreaming, because I want to talk about that, because it's an important part of Bodhi's teachings as well. So we might just have a quick break, because I've worked out how to fix this issue here, so I can make sure I'm getting my promos on, otherwise I get into trouble. But we might play a little bit of Schubert's number 9 string quartet.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks. We just had to squeeze in a quick break for our sponsors and our messages, and also to get Schubert's number 9, Allegro, or however it was.
Thanks, Schubert.
So there you go. So we just before we went to the break, we were going to come into the topic of dreams. Mm. And I'll go to you first, Bodes, because I know that on a number of occasions you've brought up, we've spoken about dreams and how important they are, or how they help you as a psychotherapist to determine a lot where people's recovery or journey has been, or where it's going. So tell me a bit about dreams.
We all dream, and we, if we're getting enough sleep, the REM function is working well, which is called rapid eye movement, so that's when we know we're dreaming. We can dream five times a night, up to 5 times a night. So that's extraordinary. My own personal experience is that at one stage, when I was actually deep in my own therapy, with another person, of course, not just by myself, I was able to recall 4 dreams a night.
Wow.
There was a volume of material that I was bringing in. But what for me, what's been really important is that dreams provide me with biographical material of my own process.
All right.
Now, one of the interesting things that neuroscience suggests is that we have roughly about 10% of knowledge of what's going on in ourselves. We have access to about roughly 10% of what our thinking is, what our fears are, what our vulnerabilities are, what our excitements are, what our intentions are.
Is that 10% of what we...
Of 100%. So we have only about 10%.
We can only access that closet at any one time,
we only have access to about 10% of what's going on inside of us.
Okay.
So all the phenomena that's been actually pushed at us constantly through the senses that we have got... And senses that we have other senses too. We could talk about 6 senses, but there's kind of levels to that, and some people can get very skilled intuitively at picking up on image, sound, shifts of consciousness in the other, which is quite remarkable. So what dreams give us is some access to the 90% of stuff that's not available to us at a conscious level.
Right.
Okay. So that's data.
Yeah.
That's phenomenological data that you that we are generating, and that dreams give us some access to. Mm. So that's one of the reasons why dreams are so useful.
Should we be recording our dreams? Should we be sort of like,
Absolutely. Because it's data that you're generating, and if you want to know about yourself, you want to capture that data. So don't let it go.
Mm. Like keep a dream diary.
Keep a dream diary. Mm. Write it down. I've got a funny story I said to this guy. Keep a dream diary. So he came in the next session. He said, yep, I wrote the dream down. I said, and so I said, we'll read it out. He said, I must remember this dream. I must remember this dream. I must remember this dream. I must remember this dream.
Far out.
So I guess we could say that's a bit of an anxiety dream.
Yeah, yeah.
But he did get more skillful, and he got access to a lot of sort of deep dreaming.
Yeah, yeah.
I make a joke of that, but what's interesting, isn't it, is it is data, information that you're generating through your dreaming function.
Yeah. Phenomenal thing.
So capture that dreaming content and look at it and consider it.
Set up a diary.
Set up a diary.
Next to your bed.
And
because because you've only got a limited time. They say it's like 8 minutes. Is that what Dr. Carl said?
The decay of a dream memory recall is within minutes. So as soon as you wake up, or if you have the dream and it wakes you up, then have the diary there ready. Capture the headings key points or the key people in the dream enough that when you wake up, they are prompts that then you can reconstruct the dream.
I'm very fortunate with regards to this because I sleep talk. And what happens is that I'll be dreaming and I'll say something in my sleep.
Right.
And I'll say it out loud. And my wife, April, what she does is then she interviews me.
Right. I hope you don't say any other name but April.
While I'm in this, that's right. While I'm in this dream state,
right.
And she records, as in she writes down these conversations, and I sort of have a recollection. So I'm not 100% asleep by all means, but I'm certainly not awake I have these.
Like you're hypnotized.
I'm hypnotized. Exactly. I'm hypnotized. Right. Yeah. So I thought for your delectation, I would read you some of these conversations that we've had.
Go right ahead, because we've got a poem from Bodes that have come as well, mate.
Here we go. So this is one that I just had recently. So I yelled out, are you okay? And she said, yeah, I'm getting the blanket. So she had moved in the bed and was sort of moving the blanket. And I said, is your hand okay? And she said, yes. Oh, that's good. Why, what's happened to my hand? Oh, you hurt it when you fell down the stairs on the way to the performance. And she says, what performance? And I said, at the Moulin Rouge. And then she says, was I performing at the Moulin Rouge? I said, yeah, you were performing with that woman who does the rostering. She had a bowl of yogurt. I had a mouthful of chicken liver.
This is hilarious.
But I had to spit it out because it didn't help with the singing. No, I know. I can imagine that wouldn't help, she says. How long would I have I been at the Moulin Rouge? And I sort of shrugged. I said, about a week. I had to go to the toilet to spit out the liver, but there was a vampire in there. Right. So that was that
one. The
walk-walk. That was the one. I'll give you a couple more.
The walk-walk.
This one night I yell out, it's corn, but it's in a can.
It's corn in a can.
It's corn, but it's in a can. And she says, what are you doing with the corn? And I said, analysing it, because you could be allergic to it, and that's not good. And are you cooking with it? No. There's a girl with a broken leg. You can go to the shops, but as far as I'm concerned, it's the corn or the broken leg. And she says, that's quite a choice to make. And I go, I'm a specialist.
She broke the leg at the Moulin Rouge.
She broke the leg at the Moulin Rouge. I've got a list of them here. I yelled out, don't let the alien chase you around the building. And she said, where are you? I said, on the set of Alien. What else is happening? Oh, I'm riding around the city delivering mail on my push bike. Well, what for? The dollars, but also to meet people.
She
goes, and then I said, if you go up the elevator, the alien will always take the stairs, so you have to check it there. She goes, are you delivering mail for aliens? I said, yeah, they're parcels. I fell off a few times, but that only makes me keener to get there on time. So even in my dreams, I'm quite work motivated. I'm keen to do a good job. So if you're a sleep talker, be interviewed.
Very good.
They're pretty funny.
All those wonderful things you can do, and you can do all this if you're getting a sleep, a dream diary as well, and all of these things. So these are Yeah, I've learned a lot today, gentlemen, and you know, there's a lot of things that I'm going to put into practice myself, and I'm sure that a lot of listeners will do as well.
I think people have often said to me when I keep a dream journal, "Gosh, I never knew I dreamed such unusual sort of kind of situations or dreams, or they're deeply moved, or someone has passed away in their life suddenly appears in a dream." Wow. And there's a communication that happens in the dream that is often very helpful, or a reminder of how much I miss that person. So you know, capturing your dreams is there's two sets of dreams, isn't it? The dreams that we have about a future that are conscious dreams. I would like to succeed in my job. That's a dream when one's working at improving one's functioning. Then there's the night dreams that are unbidden, but that come from deep within us. And they tell us strange stories, but they tell us stories of who we are and who we are becoming. And they provide invitations for growing a deeper consciousness. In Tibetan language, there's 85 words to describe consciousness, and dreams are part of that a story of consciousness. So in Tibetan practice, dreaming is a really important part of growing a consciousness. Mm. 85
well, it's,
words
it's
to
part
describe.
Part of our First Nations people. It's a huge part of their story.
The dreaming.
The dream time. It's huge.
Yeah.
There's a lot there we can...
And people who have some understanding of power animals, so, you know, an Aboriginal mobs have power animals, so they're either possum people or serpent people and that sort of stuff. So your power animal will actually show up in your dreams as well. And it will either be a hostile presence or a benign presence. But there's information always embedded in dreams. And to be able to make sense of what the dreaming information is, that is providing you some clues about either stuckness or an inflation. You become overinflated in your idea of yourself.
Wow.
Or you're deflated in your idea of yourself. So there's lots of levels to dream consideration that are extremely interesting and extremely rewarding to start.
Absolutely fascinating and rewarding, as you say. Yeah.
What about lucid dreaming? Have you ever experienced or had clients who have had the capacity for lucid dreaming where they are aware of that they are in a dream state can somewhat direct their dreaming?
Absolutely. And there's various views on lucid dreaming. But for people who suffer from nightmares of being pursued, that to be able to interfere with that recurrent ongoing dreaming by waking up in the dream enough to actually say, "I've had enough of you," is a huge game.
I have that issue a lot of the time. The only dreams I remember are the ones where I'm being chased.
A lucid function can actually then start to interrupt an old pattern of anxiety about pursuit.
Funny, you know, that some of the most bizarre and real dreams I ever had was when I was on nicotine patches. They were on, man, like seriously full on, like in a bank robbery or, you know, there's, and like, it's real.
Yeah, yeah.
And you wake up and you're in a sweat, you're like, that would...
Yes,
well, hurt anyone?
Yeah, well, the nicotine itself is a neurotransmitter. Right. So at a fundamental level, nicotine activates... receptor sites in the parasympathetic nervous system.
It's a stimulant as
well. I was just going to say, probably some of the most vivid dreams I've had was when I've been living and working in Southeast Asia and have been taking anti-malarials, Larium.
There you go, yeah, of course.
And one of the side effects of Larium is torrid dreaming states and that sort of thing. Yeah. And if people have got mental health histories, it's recommended they don't take it. Instead, there's another anti-malarial
Just get malaria instead.
What could possibly go wrong?
Doxycycline.
Doxycycline is the daily anti-malarial.
Isn't that the one you get if you've had a bad one-night stand or something? I heard on TV the other day.
Doxycycline's given as a antibiotic for things like chest infections and stuff like that.
Okay.
But it's an anti-malarial. And... I won't go into the whole doxycycline pharmacology, but it can be effective for community-acquired pneumonia.
Bodes, poem time.
Oh, yes, good idea.
We get this, we're coming to the back end of the show. We've got about 5 minutes or so left, but it's been an absolute Bobby Dazzler, boys. I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Mm. I've had a young fella who's lost his mum and dad to chronic illnesses over the last 2 years, so he's only 28, so young to deal with here. The death of mum and dad, eh?
Very young.
And then I just had a gentleman recently in his late 70s, whose wife died very suddenly, he's bereft. So this poem by Dean Atter is titled, How to Say Goodbye. Go to the crematorium, pay your respects, share fond memories, listen to the fond memories of others, give and accept hugs. Accept there is no right thing to say at a time like this. Accept whatever you feel in any given moment. Numb, angry, effing angry, effing furious. Cry at any given moment. Your tears are never inappropriate. Never too much. Never embarrassing. Though it may feel this way. You will not flood the world with your grief if you let it out. You may well drown yourself if you hold it in. Hold on to what his life, her life, meant. Drink in his memory. Drink to her memory. Drink because you need a drink. Drink some more even though you don't know you shouldn't. Pour libations to him on the carpet. Talk about him or her to people who never even knew her. Whenever and for as long as you need. Do not be afraid to say the word suicide. Hold the word out like a serpent you have tamed. Allow those with trembling hands to touch the smooth scales on the lower end of its long body while you keep a firm grip on its head. Look the serpent in the eyes as its tongue flickers. Unwrap and release yourself. Place it on the ground and let it slip away. It is not yours. Make a promise to be a friend to yourself. Know when you need support. If you ever feel your own serpent creeping up your arm, call someone with a steady hand and a firm grip. Be honest enough to admit your grief is mostly about you. Do not feel guilty when something makes you smile, laugh, or excites you so much that you momentarily forget that pain and sorrow exist in the world, let alone within you. These are the moments you live for. These are the moments that have kept you alive. Realize there is so much more grief ahead, but hopefully enough moments worth living for. Remember, none of us can make it out alive, my friend. There is no wrong way to die. And there is no right way to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a
very
good
poignant. Mate, you know, there's no right way of saying something here, you know. Mm. There's just a lot of, that's a terrific poem, though.
It is a terrific poem.
It's powerful and simple.
Yes.
But real.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, Phil Stutz, who's an American psychiatrist who...
with Jonah Hill, that's right. Yeah. On Netflix or Prime or something,
And, you know, he earned a Spurs in Rikers, which was a big jail in the USA. And he's working with very hardened sort of kind of people and criminals and people who are really stuck in places. But he came up with this triangle, and the triangle is really interesting. He says the bottom part of the triangle, which is the biggest lump of the triangle space, is pain and suffering and grief and loss and all those things and trauma. And then the second part of the triangle is uncertainty. The world is uncertain. Yes. And the top segment of the triangle is your ability to navigate these two bottom spaces in the triangle.
Yeah.
And that's mastery.
Yeah.
That's all we've got.
Mm. Yeah.
That's all we've got is our capacity to navigate between these realms.
Mm.
So interesting.
So true.
So interesting.
If you haven't seen it, anyone, it's I'm pretty sure it's not Prime. I'm pretty sure it's Netflix. It starts STUTZ, and it's a thing done by Jonah Hill, who of course has always had an issue with his weight, and it's caused a lot of anxiety and depression throughout his years. And a terrific actor, he's just in a movie that's been released called Our People, who's gone to see Stutz, and he tries to turn the issue over into doing a documentary on his life, on Stutz's life, the psychiatrist that he is. A wonderful, wonderful chap. Mm. All right, well, boys, thank you. Moz, thanks, yeah. Mate.
It's great to be back.
It is wonderful to be back, and we're going to have
such an exciting year coming up. I can't wait.
It is.
I've got so much planned.
Have you? Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. Well, let's get you back next month, which is tomorrow. You know, we're already in February. Can you believe it?
I know.
Because you two, I think, really go to blend together very well, you know, like eggs and butter.
Yeah,
you know?
Like peanut butter and honey.
There you go. Peanut butter and jelly.
Are you the peanut butter or the honey?
No.
It's just the bread in between that holds it together.
I'm yogurt and maple syrup.
Oh, you always got to do... That's why we call him Topper. He's always got to top you. You know? He's going to go one higher. You got three fish, he got five. And Boats, thanks, man. It was terrific to hear both of your points of view on such a... critical, really. Mm. And it's critical in many ways, particularly for our young, like for my kids in their teens and early 20s, such as my daughter. You know, this is a wonderful, wonderful show. So just for the listeners out there, we might be about 6 days of uploading this program or this particular show. But stay tuned, and once it's up, it'll be up, of course, on all the popular.
And I know that listening to us drone on will certainly put you to sleep.
Yes, yeah,
it'll set you up for success.
Absolutely, 100%.
All right. So until next week, all the best. It's the Men's Mental Health Show. I'm Brad Spillane. Goodbye, folks.
See you, Spillane.
See ya.
Bye.